Just notice your response to these words: emptiness, fullness. You are nothing. You are everything. You don't exist. You truly belong. Sounds like I'm saying a bunch of opposites, but actually, these words, which sound completely contradictory, are saying exactly the same thing when you really understand the non-duality of existence. And our Dharma practice is about lifting the veil of duality and coming to this sense of deep unity and belonging. We can think of awakening as the perfection of wisdom, or we can also think of it as the perfection of love. It's both things. And I want to talk about the words I used referred to each aspect, the wisdom side and the love side. These are really called the two wings of the Dharma. And they're a unity. Awakening is the perfection of love and wisdom. And what language you use, emptiness, which is kind of a negation of something, or fullness. Emptiness allows fullness, and I'll explain that later. So our proclivity might be more towards the wisdom side or the love side. So wisdom reveals we are nothing, and being nothing, we're everything. Because if there's not a separate me here, then we're just the world. We belong, truly. Or you could look at it, our love, our care for beings outside of us, as well as ourself. Love reveals we are everything, and being everything, we're nothing. Because when we are the world, then we're not a separate me. I'll say a little bit about each side, and then I'll put them together. Wisdom is really seeing things as they are. And we get it that wisdom is, you know, we go from data to information to knowledge to wisdom. And wisdom is where we take all of that and put it into experience. So wisdom is this experiential seeing clearly how things are. And in the Theravada tradition, the three key things we want to see clearly are change, and that which changes is unreliable, and there's not a separate me in charge of that change. So change and dukkha and not self are the three characteristics. Those three insights, when we see clearly, lead to deep letting go and awakening. And so from this side of practice, the primary vehicle of awakening is wisdom through awareness, through seeing clearly how things are. And what's interesting is, you know, you hear this term wisdom traditions, and all religions can be seen as wisdom traditions. They have their religious aspect, which, you know, can be rites and rituals, or it can be perverted into dogma. But the spiritual aspects are the wisdom side. And what's really interesting is you can see in all the different traditions this commonality that the essence of wisdom and seeing clearly is awakening to pure awareness. Awareness without focus or effort. Our mindfulness practice, we have focus and effort. As that matures, it heads to pure awareness, where we don't have to make effort and we don't need a focus. Awareness just is. So you can see this in the Thai forest tradition, where they talk about citta, pure awareness, or the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, where they talk about rigpa, pure awareness. We can see this in the non-dual approach to Hinduism through Advaita Vedanta. We can see this in Christianity, this emphasis on pure awareness. Here's a quote from Thomas Keating talking about where contemplative Christian practice takes us. the place to which we are going is one in which the knower, the knowing, and that which is known are all one. Awareness alone remains. The one who is aware disappears along with whatever was the object of consciousness. This is what divine union is. He's not talking about Christ or the Trinity or God or the commandments. He's talking about the experiential realization of Christian teachings, which is pure awareness. And in pure awareness, the me and you dissolves. The inside and the outside dissolves. There's just divine union. You see this in Islam through Sufism. And then you can see this in, you know, kind of what we call the post-Buddhist world and teachers like Adyashanti. His book is, you know, he has a book called True Meditation, Discover the Freedom of Pure Awareness. So wisdom traditions come together in this realization of awareness without focus or effort, pure awareness. And that dissolves a sense of a separate me. And after I had done a six-week retreat, I found myself saying this to my mother-in-law. You know, I'd had this kind of deep unity experience on that retreat. And I found myself saying these words. I was surprised. I said to Sherston, my mother-in-law, I think I know what God is. She said, really? And what is that? And I said, the absence of Peter. So this is the wisdom side of practice. I want to say a little bit about the love side. And on the love side, we talk about loving kindness. The Buddhist tradition really defines loving as wishing someone well. And we do that with metta practice. And metta cultivates this unconditional or basic friendliness. Sharon Salzberg likes to quote this Issa couplet, in the cherry blossom's shade, there's no such thing as a stranger. Now, we understand there's this friendliness that we can have towards other beings. And why aren't we in that friendliness all the time? Well, it's due to our mental habits. Love is really a practice. Our ability to love is not some pre-given character trait like, oh, he's a loving person, she's not a loving person. No, it's really our mental habits. What are we practicing a lot? In the play and movie Wicked, Dorothy asked the bad witch, how did you get to be so bad? And the bad witch says, practice. So what are we practicing? If we're angry a lot, we're practicing anger. The more we practice anger, the easier it becomes. Whatever you do repeatedly in your mind becomes your habit. If you practice remembering our shared humanity, no matter how much we disagree with somebody in their point of view or their actions or their speech, if we remember our shared humanity, we can remember metta. We will be practicing friendliness. And when I was on a retreat, I did metta for several days for a neutral person, somebody that I didn't know at all, never spoken to. And it's funny, I ended up feeling so friendly to this person. I would seek this person out. I would try to sit near them in the dining hall. You know, I started to really, really like this person. I'd never said a word to them. So, you know, I realized, wow, it's what I'm doing in my mind affects how friendly and loving I feel. So our metta really gets messed up because our love is so much about desire, trying to get what we want from someone. And this is attached love. And metta is very simple. We can just have our little love light on and it can just beam out. And whoever comes, you know, in the light gets illuminated. But the way we love is much more complicated. You know, we have so many desires for so many things from people. And here's a little perspective on love from kids, just, you know, kind of humor around the complexity. So Mike, age 10, answers the question, what do most people do on a date? On the first date, they just tell each other lies. And that usually gets them interested enough to go for a second date. Callie, age 9, answers the question, when is it okay to kiss someone? Never kiss in front of other people. It's a big embarrassing thing if anybody sees you. But if nobody sees you, I might be willing to try it with a handsome boy, but just for a few hours. Gary, age 7, on the role of good looks than love. It isn't always just how you look. Look at me. I'm handsome like anything, and I haven't gotten anybody to marry me yet. Roger, age 8, on how to make love endure. Don't forget your wife's name. So, real metta is loving somebody just as they are. And there's a really funny cup thing from The Onion where it says, the headline is, Father only expresses love through proper concern for proper, tire inflation. The article describes how emotionally distant Earl Kolchak of Rocky Mountain, North Carolina, expresses his love for his 17-year-old daughter, Jessica, the only way he knows how, by inquiring about the pressure of the 4 Firestone radial tires on a 1995 Ford Festiva. Kolchak took his love for his daughter a step further by personally checking the tires with a handheld pressure gauge, but later felt embarrassed by the expression of intimacy. So can we love Earl Kolchak just as he is, a little scared to show his feelings? So metta, loving people just as they are. And then back to wisdom, how do we put wisdom and love together? Again, they're flip sides of the same coin. Through wisdom, we realize emptiness. But when we're empty of a separate self, then we're full of the world. Being nothing, we're everything. Being empty, we're full to the brim. Not existing, one belongs completely. Love and wisdom come together. And we can have this analogy that the awake heart is like big open space impregnated with light. And we don't see the light in space unless an object arises in it. And then we see the light. So our big spacious heart is illuminated with love, and the expression of our empty heart is love. When we're in contact with something, automatically we feel love when we're in this big space, you know, of pure awareness. And so wisdom purifies our love into great love. We can love all beings because our little love light is just on, because we're not blinded by attachment or desire. We're just big open space, radiant with light, illuminating any being we encounter with love. And again, you know, purified love is space-like. We can just let people be what they are. A bucking bronco can't kick space. We can let somebody buck and kick because we're just big open space. But that space is imbued with affection. We love people just as they are. So we realize wisdom and love when our practice matures through pure awareness. And then we might have this experience of what Rilke talked about. He wrote, not to be cut off, not through the slightest partition, shut out from the law of the stars. The inner, what is it? If not intensified sky, hurled through with birds, and deep with the winds of homecoming.